Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Renee Alberts, guest host of Prosody, and my guest is the poet Joshua Young. Joshua Young is the author of When the Wolves Quit, a play in verse published by Goldwake Press, and To the Chapel of Light on Mudlish's Press Nephew, as well as a forthcoming collaboration with Chaz Hopp, The Digesis, also on Goldwake Press. He studies poetry in the MFA program at Columbia College Chicago, where he also teaches writing and serves as an editor for the Columbia Poetry Review. Welcome, Joshua.
Thanks for having me here.
Sure. Can you start us off with some poems?
Yeah, I'll read from When the Wolves Quit, and each poem has stage direction, or a scene setting. Spotlight, center stage, Sunday, 8 a.m. This town is built on the vanishings. It's part of everyone's story. There's a list for each name. It's tacked to the wall under the clock in the sheriff's office. The preacher disappears. No one notices till the church service Sunday when the pews fill up and the sermon never comes. From the pews, a rumble of whispers begins sometime in the silence and rumors swell like a new bruise. Smiles creep up faces, some frown and some keep their lips and only listen to what gets said. The preacher's brother took two elders down the block to the preacher's house and came back saying there was no answer at its door. Inside, his bed is unmade, and there's probably a week's worth of dust on things. Someone mentions the ghost woods. That gets the congregation praying. Stage lights up. Catherine Hansen's dream sequence. At first, they thought it was the plague. Said it was only a matter of time till we were all bodies in a pile outside our own front doors. But all I smell are oranges and charcoal. People stood on their porches for better views, as if a crowd of eavesdroppers could cure just by listening or watching the scenes unfold. But I flee, quick and quiet like a fox stealing apples from the prison yard, and they follow as voices usually do. Just marionettes gone free, shaking and rattling around upstairs whenever a memory gets triggered or brought up. These things are not the things we lost in the fire, not the leftovers of post-teen angst or the hush of harbors at twilight. This is heavy and sudden, like catching an anchor in the chest. Is that laughter or coughing coming from the tree line? Maybe it's just a coyote lurking in the brush, because here, secrets are damp, caught in the space between the throat and the front teeth. They only let them go when the time calls for it. And someone important is listening. No, it's Casey, and she hasn't had a holiday in ages, years maybe. Today she's waiting in hospitals, the burn ward, a thick smile sliding out from under a hood like a slit of sunlight through a keyhole as if she knows we will burn and burn soon. A train moans six blocks over and I'm hiding behind a stop sign, but something calls me inside. Something like an arpeggio in the key of D, dissected and put back together, then fed back into itself. By the time the door's shut behind me, it's too late. I'm staring at her. As she takes me by the arm, she keeps saying, "This is the undanced cadence of vanishing." Cue backdrop, what the kids call the ghost woods. The ghost woods first showed themselves in autumn after the first vanishing, when the loggers started cutting their way and found shallow graves. The sheriff, then barely 2 weeks in, came back with the men to find only a wall of trees, no graves, no work done, and a pair of sandals that belonged to a girl who'd vanished just days before. It didn't smell of oranges and charcoal, never has, but of swamp water and wet cedar. Kids say the trees uprooted themselves, plucked the bodies from the ground, and cleaned the scene. Now people say all that's there are walking skeletons and ghosts with all their ghost hair getting stuck in branches collected in holes, their ghost voices howling like wolves, breathing like rakes, scraping their way across the highway. That afternoon he went back to his office and wrote her name on the list. Years later he would write Ghost Woods across the top. Not that he believed it, but the town did and he didn't want to rule anything out. The list been keeping him busy, unmarried, but never lonely. He's got each name and each life to keep it entertained. He likes to imagine their lives unfolding, picturing what led them to the ghost woods, though nothing could explain that type of wandering. And as the names gather on paper, on his walls, he can't imagine scenarios, and this lack wobbles around like a loose tooth for years. Enter, stage right. There's blood in the orchard, but no body. In the spider light of an orchard, a girl found dirt and blood in rows, bruised into the ground. She moves to stay warm and alert among the shadows, shivers, cause this dark cold sticks to the body, gathers and tugs little flocks of night-like cattle at the spark of winter, and siren light clears the shadow back to where it came from. And all that color wakes her from her stupor and shaking to recall and retell what's been done. Lights fade to darkness. Offstage, The Killing of Ruth Collins by Russell Lee, number 20. There are crimes and there are crimes of passion. If someone found him right afterwards, he'd probably say it was neither but a necessity born out of shame. Today he'd tell you otherwise, and he tries to scrape it from his past like bark from a tree, but it's tied to his ribcage and only tightens when he tries to free it. The night it went down, he entered through the back, put a burlap bag over his head, stood over the bed, once theirs, and used a pillow to muffle the shots. Instead of shooting, he used the pillow to snuff her out. Took 3 hours of sitting inside his car 3 blocks down across the ballpark, loading and unloading shells into the chamber of his pistol, walking through how it would go. When it was over, he remembered how she'd lay herself on the living room floor, fold her arms across her chest and say, "This is what I'd look like in a casket," and "Am I still pretty when I'm dead?" People fall in love in the key of C and out of it with dissonance, climbing its way into a scale. That night, he made her bed, cleaned the house, and carried her from the house to his car and left her body a mile from the quarry in the place the kids call the Ghost Woods. He tells bartenders about his dreams, the one starting after and about, always clicking with the chamber of his pistol and saying, "What I do and what I should are like brothers." Her name was number 20 on the list. Today, the sheriff found parts of her body under a stump. One of the deputies says, "Who's that?" The sheriff straightens up and pulls the list from his shirt pocket. He unfolds it and reads her name as though he's never read before. Sometimes songs begin almost like this.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Renee Alberts, and my guest is the poet Joshua Young, reading from his collection of poetry, When the Wolves Quit. So can you talk about the decision to write poetry in verse?
Well, I have a background in fiction and film, and I just started writing these as poems about small-town murders, and slowly I realized that it was structured almost like a play because most of the violence happens off stage, and most of the action happens with the Ghost Woods and people trying to figure out where these people have disappeared to. And so as that started to happen, I realized that it sort of was lending itself to a play format. So, I mean, the form doesn't actually look like a play because all the scene directions and dialogue, it looks like poetry. But every title sort of like frames it as a scene from a play or something that is off stage in the play.
Can you talk about how something like stage directions or signaling that things are acts, how that functions differently as a poem than it would how it functions in your poem than it would if as actual stage direction or in a play?
I think one thing is in the poem, it sort of drives a narrative forward. And also in the book, there are letters. So there's two narratives working, three if you think about it. But the story of the town and the sheriff trying to uncover these murders and the murders that have happened before the story begins. And then you have what happens in the letters, which someone who comes in the middle of it and sort of leaves before it's over. And so it's kind of intertwining. In terms of how the poems work, it's almost like I'm trying to give the reader like a setting before I jump into this story, especially placing it in journals. You sort of have to give them like a quick graphs to like anchor onto before you jump into this story that they don't know about.
I'm glad that you said that because I do feel in the poems that you jump into the story. Mm-hmm. When you hear them or when you read them, you start them off with things like there are crimes and there are crimes of passion, and then boom, you're like launched into the story. Or it's being told, as in the poem, Catherine Hansen, is that the?
Yeah.
In her poem, you're hearing the story from her perspective, and it's told as though, almost as though you know what it is. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about like composing with that sort of immersive perspective?
Like jumping straight into what's going on? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think cinematically when I'm thinking about the scenes, so there's like a narrative driving it. So in terms of that, I like narratives that start in the middle of something. If you ever watched the movie Squid and the Whale, every scene starts in the middle of the scene, especially the opening of the movie starts on that tennis court.
Mm-hmm.
And I want that sort of feeling when you jump into, especially a narrative poem. You don't want to start like, today I woke up and did this. You want something that's starting in the action. So that's how I think about approaching something that's a narrative. In terms of getting into what the character is doing in that moment, I don't know. I just jump in and try to like understand what that character would be doing. Which sounds really simple. I don't know.
No, how do you do that? I mean, that's one of my questions.
For you. You just try to write from their perspective without trying to judge who they are. You let them come to you. So, mm-hmm. you know, Catherine Hansen is this person, and you just sort of start writing their story and you let it go where it's going to go. You don't try to control it, because you start to control it, it starts to feel contrived, or it becomes the same story you've heard before.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of this book, if I tried to make all the characters following roles, familiar roles that we've seen before. So like, you know, whether it's like the abusive relationship or like the stalker relationship or whatever, we've all seen those and you're familiar. And so when you jump into a poem, you might think, oh, I've seen this before. Mm-hmm. But the characters are constantly trying to escape their roles in this book, like especially the sheriff. He's trying to get out of this role of the guy who's chasing these things. And he can't escape the roles. And it's a lot about these characters trying to get out and pushing against that wall, but not being able to get out. And I think that kind of helps with just letting the characters do. Mm-hmm. And that kind of gives them room to like elbow their way in where their character is expected to go.
So you speak like a filmmaker almost. But I'm also hearing that you want to, when you're writing, you let things go. So I'm curious about your composition, because it seems like you have this structure in mind, and you have these acts and these scenes and, you know, this direction. And if you read through the book there, it's very intentional. You go through, you know, a scene of a character's monologue, and then you have one of the dear brother, dear sister letters. And then you move along through these different sort of forms of poems. But I'm curious about your composition, because it sounds like you both, on one hand, have all of that sort of structure, and on the other hand, you're saying you write and let the character go. So how does that work in the actual writing?
I think, I have like a structure in terms of like the form overall. So like three act play, mm-hmm. right? But in terms of the story, I kind of have an ending figured out, but I let that sort of, I don't let it like rule what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times it'll change. But I am a filmmaker. That's what I did when I lived in Washington. I wrote and directed films, and I studied film theory. And so that's part of like what drives the need for a structure, especially in my narrative mind.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't like narratives that do the same thing or like follow a path. I like when they veer off course and they push the boundaries of what's supposed to be. And so when I approach it, I try to, I know where I'm going, but I want to like take the long way there. Does that make sense?
It does make
sense. Okay.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Renee Alberts, and my guest is the poet Joshua Young, reading from his work. Can we hear some more poems?
Yeah. I'll read some poems from To the Chapel of Light.
Okay.
This is actually a film in verse, even though it doesn't say so in the title. These are companion pieces, and there's actually a third book that's structured as a symphony. That's out for consideration at presses. So I'll start from the beginning and sort of jump around.
Okay.
Interior apartment night. A poet comes to my door with snakes wrapped around his arms and says he's going to pull a fiddle from the throat of a sparrow. No one believes him. His friend, another poet, makes everything worse, keeps saying, I like it when a camera stops outside the door like this and just waits a minute, listens. And then he tries to pull an organ from the speakers of a stereo. Rubbing the snakes wrapped around his arm, the poet says, that's not what we came here for. And so the friend of the poet closes his eyes and opens his mouth, but the words sound like mud sliding off a roof. He clears his throat and waits a moment. And then he starts talking about the camera. Fade to black. Interior car day. The radio dial turns from static to fuzz, and there's the voice of a preacher, or maybe not a preacher, maybe just a man who has something to say, and he speaks, continues, "What should you do? Look, if you push hard enough, you'll see the whole thing turn to stone. 'Cause here everyone wants to settle up, tear the roots from the dirt, and give that blacktop the old rubber and exhaust. You couldn't really call it traveling so much as a kind of hand washing or the tearing out of pages. We were born anchors, and you will drag against the state line, only half fracturing the distance between home and out there, because home just threads itself deep into the skin, and you'll keep saying, we'll get there somehow. Cut two. Dear brothers, as we move, that line slumps across the horizon, keeps pulling at what's left of the light. No sleek edges of skyscrapers. Here it's all sun and reflection, or maybe gold buried in the ground. And in the distance, they stand calling from rocks and water for skin and nerve static, or maybe just bodies to stitch into what's left of the south. All that dirt road kick up and follow through collects like the patter of feet gathering up a staircase. Listen to the hiccup of a body's lust for a soft spot to lay itself. And we should not answer their calls from rocks. We should not shed our clothes like shucking corn. We pull ourselves anyway towards the choir. Dear brothers, we can see it from this place. The air tastes like whiskey and snow, but the summit is warm and dry enough to sit on the ground. The chapel is down there behind the lake, light popping from its every crease and opening like the earth just clicked its shutter. And there's a procession of ghosts and soldiers spreading all the way to the foot of what we stand on. The water leading towards the lake has started to boil and turn brown, and all the soldiers keep kneeling to scald what's left from their bones. They just want to be naked, just bones. The poet and his friend did not warn us of this, but I can see God down there with his son camped out on the far end of the next pass that leads to the musk and the cold of the city, barely breathing. They watch the procession and the son bites his father's nails. The young priest is there with them, in front of a fire, trying to burn the spirit from his palms. It's not the wind we can hear howling through the pass. It's the voice of the spirit begging for mercy, begging to stay put, deep in the creases of the priest's palms.
So we've talked a lot about the sort of structure behind the poems. I want to switch a little bit and ask about some of the really great images that you have and some of the descriptions that you use. Some of the lines that I wrote down from both books that you've read so far were images like, is that laughing or coughing coming from the trees and ghosts with all their ghost hair? And then you have a lot of really nice similes in this piece that you just read from, things like mud sliding off a roof, the voice like mud sliding off a roof. The air tastes like whiskey and snow, and like the earth just clicked its shutter. So can you talk a little bit about how you come to images like that, how you come to language like that in your work?
Well, I steal a lot. So a lot of what I steal helps inform that. I don't always steal exactly the same line, although mm-hmm. sometimes I do. But I think I just go, if I notice an image that's interesting, mm-hmm. like whether I'm writing or whether I see something, I try to find the strangest way to say it or to compare something to something that it shouldn't be compared to. I had my mentor at Western Washington University, Oliver De La Paz. We talked a lot about similes because simile is like the easiest refuge for a poet. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to get away from overusing them, but these books I use a lot. I cut a lot out in the process of editing these, but the idea is when using metaphor or using any sort of simile, you want to make it something that the reader does not expect at all, but it still has to come from the world of the poem or the book or the story or whatever. So I try to find the comparisons that kind of clash. I don't know. It's hard to explain that process, but it's just a lot of like trying things out till it like, you know, when you read something out loud and you're just like, oh, that's it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I should give credit. This book started Two poets came and read at my house in Bellingham, Noah Eli Gordon and Josh Marie Wilkinson, are two of my favorite poets. And there was like a big thing that happened there. A drunk poet claimed they were being mean. So I wrote this poem for the class. But the line says he's going to pull a fiddle from the throat of a sparrow is actually the title of Noah Eli Gordon's book.
Oh, okay.
And the line, I like it when a camera stops outside the door like this and just waits a moment, listens, is from Joshua Mee Wilkinson's.
Oh, so when you say steal, you mean like you lift things directly?
Yeah.
Do you credit them in your books?
No, but I told them at AWP.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll get political, but some of the things I steal, it's like a matter of just hearing like a song on the radio and writing it down.
Mm-hmm.
I probably should have credited them, and we just didn't. But I told them, and I think I sent them a book. So I think they'll forgive me for
it. Beg forgiveness or ask permission?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess we'll find out.
Okay. Can you read us some more work?
Yeah, I can. I'm going to move on. I'll move on to the diegesis.
Okay.
And I'll have my friend Sarah come up and read with me.
Okay. And Sarah Tarkany is going to be reading this poem with Josh. And so there will be two voices at the same time, correct?
Yes. So I wrote this with someone named Chaz, but he lives in Bellingham. So when I read this out at readings, I have a friend come up and read with me. These don't have titles. It's just part of the diegesis. You want the past to mean everything. Do you remember it, like me?
The first time you bit foil, the gaslight is going, the anchor set, and this moment
lulls, then skids through the living room. Sometimes you can see the trash.
Re-entering the atmosphere, the freeway curses from down the hill. You lost the package somewhere around the bend.
Though you've gained an idea, but of course we can't forget the drunk girls walking home.
In clusters, microbrews, and corners of bowling alleys, and your face tells me to keep it shut.
Even though you're just staring, you look left then right before throwing peanut shells.
On the barroom floor, the partition wakes in the tension, your confession slithers around.
The dark spaces you let build between you and the other guy,
a confession. My white boy guilt still makes me flinch at the word jigger. There are four of us and the gas
is gone. That's a Texas jaw we hear, not what we hope for. Here, you breathe out a lazy quip
that manages somehow to define the journey. This is where they summit and plunge.
All that booze, bump, and bar talk bleed. They pulled what they could from
their bodies and bone left hollowed and stale. This is how myths are created. Right now, someone's
painted Jesus saves under the overpass where the homeless go. They put the bums
to work now, you know. Got them selling activist rags while wearing sandwich boards.
On street corners, through the window, the city solidifies. Inside the mechanical
doors are like Star Wars with kinks. Watch the men retreat. Of course,
this is before the shooting at the Jewish center, the gridlocks, the newscopters.
We're solid, but the present slows, keeps us quiet. It's the coming out that tells the tale.
Outside, the jaw keeps on. There's a story in these tea leaves, to be sure. But now,
to suspend your disbelief.
So what kind of film stock are we using? Yes, we've memorized the images of who we were at 20, but that's only for photographs and Super 8.
Five, I'm going to be more famous than you even realize.
Everything became sepia and musk. That pale gossip of adolescence scuttled blacktops, circled the tether, and jigged its way into the mouths of hallways.
Six, my brother
it's
keeps
the coming
calling,
out that
and
tells
I refuse
the
to take his calls. The
we
phones
put a hole
unvibrate,
in the drywall.
And Cohen's playing, and you haven't dressed
we
for the scene.
We cleared a hole in the floor and laughed
the frame,
into the space.
Nines and all. I was
inside
never actually
the darkness
clear
chewed our
on
flashlights
the reason why
and
this mess chugged through our neighborhood. The language gets rough around the second act. He's all sideburns and polo shirts. I haven't let go of that kind of anger. I never have anything good to say on telephones. It's all touching base and catch up. I had lectures planned, but they were just hot air left over from my Bible days. I'm tired of setting fires to bridges and the houses above them. There are songs about this kind of meeting, but I've only heard them distorted in bar light, the lights stringing the block flare in the lens, and just outside the frame, our mother has something awful to say.
We have time for one more short poem.
Okay. This one is from a collection I'm working on. It's going to be my thesis at Columbia College Chicago. It's 19 It's based on like 1980s punk, set in Seattle. And this one's called Halloween at the Madison and the Reagan Pinata. Mohawks aren't the thing anymore, so 77. At the Halloween bash, everyone's gone skinhead and all the bands play in Reagan masks. There's no trouble tonight. The only bloods in the churn are coming from the knuckles of the Kill Room's drummer. His snare's stained from months of touring. We want the light to sway when the song goes, and for a moment it does. M buys a Reagan pinata and we take turns busting it into chunks. There are pictures of this in a gallery on campus. We look like we are part of something huge. We look famous in the freeze frame.
The poetry of Joshua Young. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you too, Sarah. You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30, for Prosody 90.5 FM.